You are listening to the second of two News Project podcasts for the week of March 30th, 2020, brought to you by GNAT TV. This podcast brings you these stories. Feeding Arlington children during COVID-19. BRSU's many challenges. Weston looks into lowering taxes. Stratton Foundation's COVID Relief Fund. And BBA's remote learning program.
Area schools are stepping up to deliver food along with other supplies to students as the COVID-19 crisis tightened its grip around the region and the state. Over at Arlington Memorial High School, the school cafeteria has been transformed into a center for preparing and organizing the delivery of breakfasts and lunches along three routes that fan out across the Arlington and Sandgate communities, starting at around 9 a.m., making stops at the regular bus stops. Nearly 200 students are now involved in this breakfast and lunch program. Any student who lives in Arlington who's under the age of 18 qualifies for the food service, whether or not they attend one of the schools in the Arlington School District or Battenkill Valley Supervisory Union. William Basic, the superintendent of the Battenkill Valley Supervisory Union, explains how it works.
We are not signed up for the summer meal program. In order to be reimbursed for our meal plans that we're serving our students right now, we had to apply for an emergency grant through the state of Vermont. The state of Vermont had to apply for an emergency waiver from the FDA, and that was able to be done rather quickly. The good news is that was done so quickly, we were able to start serving meals to all our residents, not just the free and reduced population, starting last Wednesday. So all our population under the summer meals program, anybody under the age of 18 can get a breakfast and a lunch from us 5 days a week, regardless of income level. In fact, they don't even have to show their income, and we've had a lot of people take advantage of that.
During the morning, the scene is a bustle of activity as school officials, teachers, and volunteers help gather and then load the food onto three waiting buses. There's also a pickup point at the school for those who prefer to obtain the breakfasts and lunches that way. Deanne Lacoste, the principal at Fisher Elementary School, describes how it works.
We started, as Mr. Basic said, a very low number, and we are exceeding about 175 meals each day, and actually I just received two new ones, so we'll be well close to 200 probably by the end of the week. So we currently operate two bus runs where we have people on the buses to then drop the food at bus stops, and parents meet up there and we drop off breakfast and lunch.
A similar push is underway up at the Manchester Elementary Middle School, where upwards of 400 students are able to access breakfast and lunches. Kelly Foster, the Bennington-Rutland Supervisory Union's Food Service Director, tells us about what's going on.
So right now we're distributing between delivery and pickups 400 meals to students, to 400 students, which is actually 800 meals because we're doing breakfast and lunch. You know, that includes Floodbrook, Manchester, Dorset, Currier, Sunderland, and Meadowee. And I would say a little over half of those families we are delivering.
So in these bags,
one of the school bus drivers took us inside.
This numerical system, Manchester, delivery of one meal goes by how many kids are in each household. I've set them up numerically in the bus, so it's easier to figure them out. One meal, two meal, three meal, four meal. And then back here, we also have the households that have four kids. Manchester, delivery of four meals. Now, there's two meals in each bag, so if there's four kids, they're gonna get two of these bags. That way there, it's easier to maintain the meals in the bag so nothing gets damaged. That's pretty much it. We got meals to deliver, so we're on the road.
It makes you realize the role and degree that schools play in the lives of their students and families that extends beyond the classroom. For the GNAT TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever. On Thursday, March 26th, Governor Phil Scott ordered school districts and buildings to remain closed for the rest of the school year for in-person instruction. Education will continue, as best as possible, via remote online channels, in addition to other materials teachers will be attempting to send to their students. The unprecedented situation created from the spread and concerns about the COVID-19 virus has educators scrambling to develop ways of continuing learning through the remainder of the school year on the fly. We talked with Jacqueline Wilson, the superintendent of the Bennington-Rutland Supervisory Union, about how that effort is going and what are some of the issues involved through a remote Zoom meeting.
A lot of folks that have put in for exemptions, not a lot, but they're all legit, you know, and so we'll work through that as we, you know, we have some folks that are really working on the front lines every single day, and I don't know how we would do it without them. And, you know, the folks that are making our meals for kids, delivering our meals for kids, that are putting learning packets together. So those are things that we're just really aware of and paying attention to keep them safe and to really thank them for all the work that they are doing and putting themselves out there for us. The big one right now will be for us, you know, we'll start to move into this phase. The Secretary of Ed put out new guidance on the continuity of education planning template, which went out on Saturday. And I will say, I think some of that plan was pretty unrealistic. It looks like the ideal plan, if you had 2 years to implement distance learning, and that was going to be your major platform, but we're in an emergency situation. So we're going to need to work through that and see what is reasonable and what is not. So that right now is our most challenging issue on the table for us, is how do we get everybody, you know, how do we get everybody mobilized? We want to reach all of our kids, but how do we make that equitable? How do we give them the access that they all need? You know, we have kids that don't have reliable access to internet, so that's huge. And on Wednesday, I am meeting with all of my principals. That was their kind of their drop dead date. We've done a survey with parents to try to figure out internet status, but now we're doing follow up phone calls, and I need a solid list by Wednesday so we can really start to plan how we're going to support those kiddos that will not have, you know, access to internet, and what will that look like. So that's our big one right now. And teachers this week are meeting when I call horizontal teams, they're meeting by grade level across the whole supervisory union to do some planning together, because we have to be prepared for being able to provide education when people get sick. I mean, we're going to have teachers get sick, and we can't call in a sub. So how do we make sure we can still continue to support kids in that eventuality?
Would the remote learning be completely like online, or do you anticipate it being supplemented by, let's say, deliveries from the school, like lesson plans from the school itself that would be distributed to the students, you know, on the school bus or something?
Yeah, it will be a mix. So we don't want kids having too much screen time. So, you know, we'll have some, and our goal is, you know, maybe 2 times a week, teachers are maybe holding some online experiences for kids, but it may not be, and it may not be interactive. It may be that they've done a screencast of a lesson and they've put that out, and then they follow up with kids in small groups, or they give a phone call, or they check in on their learning. But there will absolutely be a component that we're delivering every single week that's, you know, more of the hard copy. But we'll also be, you know, keep a journal, make sure you're keeping up with your reading. You know, is there a project that will get you outdoors and you know, with a science angle to that? So we'll be putting those types of work together in our packets. And that's where we think the power will come from, our teachers working across the whole supervisory union to plan so that they can share that and that they can together come up with those ideas that might, things that will work for kids that will not require them to be, you know, looking at a screen. Because I will tell you, I mean, my work has totally transitioned to the last couple of weeks, is I am only on a screen. So I've had days where I'm, you know, 12 hours and I'm just in front of a screen and it makes you crazy. It's exhausting. It's not good. It's not the right, it's not a good way to operate. And I do not want to do that to kids.
School districts will have to come up with their plans for remote learning by April 13th. The state will also be tackling the question of what to do for graduation exercises and end of year ceremonies by the 8th of May. For the GNAT TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever.
I run this one by Jim the other day. Not knowing how long people may be out of work and how serious things are, I was wondering if we might consider either, well, researching how it could be done, but I suspect we'd have to have a special town meeting and go through our couple of our appropriations, mainly the $90,000 for bridge replacement and probably $35,000 for fire truck replacement. I'm not sure if there, another one could be put in there, but withdraw them from our budget for this year in order to lower the tax rate by probably 6 cents. In order to help out people who may be out of work or strapped for money because of this crisis, which is nobody's doing. I mean, it's nothing that any of us have done. It's something come on to us. And it's something that we may have to research or act on fairly quickly, because I think we have to set the tax rate somewhere around first part of July, don't we?
Yes.
Yeah. I think that's an idea that is really worth considering, but there's a lot of research that goes into that, you know, basically changing a budget that was approved at town meeting.
Yeah.
Like I said, it might have to have a special town meeting, but I think the simplest place to start would be call Secretary of State and ask them how we do it.
I can do that if you want me to call them.
Okay, yeah. Just explain what we want to do and see if they have a problem with it.
Okay.
And I will, I can call VLCT. They might have some thoughts on it too. And Kim, you and I can talk.
Okay.
But yeah, I'm just thinking that I know several local outfits that have already laid off people, and if this continues, yeah, the virus might stop, but how long is it before the outfits get back up to speed and get going?
Yeah. One thought that occurs to me, I'm not sure this is a productive thought, but, for landlords, for people who own rental properties, it would, I'm just wondering how we would be sure that whatever savings got passed on to the tenants, or maybe, maybe that doesn't make any difference. Maybe you just help out who you can, but, just a thought.
Correct. I mean, I kept
searching what other people are doing, what at a state level or other towns or whatever are doing.
Yeah.
I think conduct the research, and then I think we need to discuss it, because it's really hard to determine where you draw the lines, who gets the help, who doesn't. So I think we should really discuss it more thoroughly.
No question. But if it's, excuse me, if it's impossible for us to do it legally,
right,
then we don't have much to discuss.
Exactly.
But if it is possible, which I think we're going to know a lot more about after Kim and I make calls, then we can discuss it more. Yeah.
Okay.
One point of information we should gather, and I guess we could get that from the listers, is how many full-time rental properties there are in town. I'm not talking about Airbnbs, but houses that people own and are rented full 12 months of the year by the same person.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you're talking about trying to be equitable and stuff. So you got, I think you got to figure out how many of them properties are around and how many people might be affected by that.
In response to the coronavirus pandemic, many nonprofit organizations are trying to adjust and ramp up their efforts to continue their missions. One of them is the Stratton Foundation, which has been trying to provide help and support for lower-income Vermonters and help them break the poverty cycle that keeps generations of families stuck in neutral and unable to break out of. Their goal is to end that cycle by helping at-risk children become successful adults. The foundation has established the COVID-19 Relief Fund to address the urgent needs of Vermont children and families, and we talked by Zoom with Tammy Mosier, the executive director of the foundation, about how that effort is going.
We've launched the our COVID Relief Fund, and our goal is to put $250,000 into the community as urgent needs are happening and as they surface long term. We are prioritizing those vital services that provide survival to families. You know, for the past couple of weeks, we have been joining on a lot of phone calls, learning what schools are doing. You know, with school closure, they've been always providing lunches to kids, right? Breakfast and lunches throughout the school day. And these kids rely on that as their primary source of food. Now the schools are faced with delivery. And I know that Leland and Gray, for example, the first week they had 50 kids that they were delivering food to. Now they're up to 185, expecting it to hit 300 and something. So, you know, just for us to be poised and ready for when these organizations need financial support to execute these critical services on the ground. I mean, to hear that the schools are functioning on staffs with a staff of 8 volunteers, you know, delivering food, putting food on school bus routes, that's something I'm not sure our schools and small organizations were prepared to do. And so the Stratton Foundation is going to be providing critical services and financial support for them to be able to execute. We recently supported a community food program with Stratton, and they've just delivered 150 packages that provide a meal for a family of 3 to 4 throughout the community. So we're going to have to be creative, and we're going to have to figure out ways to solve this and support our community long term.
And the response from the folks that you work with through the foundation has been, I gather, fairly positive.
Fairly positive, wonderfully positive, actually. People are incredibly compassionate to this area that they love and they cherish. This is all of our community. We're all neighbors, you know, whether you're here full time or not. So very united, and the response has been wonderful. We had our largest fundraiser, the 24 Hours of Stratton, be canceled, and so in March from the pandemic. And so we are switching gears and just wanting to be here for those critical needs. That was halted when the schools were closed down. Our in-school dental hygienist, the oral health has kind of been put on hold for kids that were receiving those services within the walls of the school. We were doing a mental health program at it actually included 5 schools within the area to address teen mental health and suicide prevention. That got stopped. We funded a mentorship program with Burn Burton Success Kids, who are mentees who their mentees are from MEMS. And that's been ongoing, but it's all on social media. And we're waiting to see what our life-changing summer scholarships, if they will be able to take place or not. So yeah, unfortunately, a lot of the programs that we were supporting within the schools have been affected for sure. But things like feeding kids and continuing with mental health, that has definitely risen to the top of our priorities right now.
Even when the immediate emergency caused by the coronavirus pandemic subsides, there'll be a lot of catch-up work to do. If you know of a nonprofit organization that's filling the gap or trying to, send an email to news, N-E-W-S, at gnet-tv.org, and we'll try to help you get the word out. For the GNET TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever.
The main thing I wanted to ask you all about was, how are you going to be structuring the remote learning now that the school building is going to be closed for, I guess, the rest of the school year? How are you setting that up, and how is it going to work? Is it going to be all online, or is there going to be an online component and then maybe sort of, for lack of a better term, hard copy lesson plans going home in some way or another? How's it all going to work?
So can I start, and then I'm going to turn it over to Meg and John, because they can speak much more thoroughly about the details. But your question was, how is it going to be? And I want to tell you, it has been for 2 weeks now. We've been deep into online learning right from the get-go. The day after we shut down daily operations, we were prepared to launch online synchronous and asynchronous learning with our students. And I think it's been kind of an incredible, an interesting and challenging experience, but incredible in a lot of good ways. So with that, I think Meg and John, you two should talk about what we've been doing.
Sure. I think, Andrew, one of the things that we did was when things started to become apparent that COVID-19 was going to impact our area, while school was still open, we had put together a team, and our academic leadership, which John Graff is a part of as a department chair, we started to brainstorm and develop kind of a skeleton plan for what we would do if school had to be shut down and what that online learning would look like, or a remote learning plan would look like. So we decided that we immediately assessed our students' access to robust Wi-Fi and cell phone data capability, and identified pockets of students that were going to need some support there, either troubleshooting getting more reliable Wi-Fi or data, or identifying students that weren't easily going to fit into an online mode. So we had all that information before school even shut down. And then we also decided we would come up with what our online learning day would look like. And what that is we've kept our same schedule. So students meet remotely with all of their classes each day, but in a more abbreviated fashion. So instead of our 85-minute blocks, we have 40-minute blocks. And then at the end of that, there's a time period that we're calling office hours, where students can check in with students. And we're primarily using Google platforms, because that's what a lot of teachers in the school were using. At the time, Zoom wasn't free when we made this skeleton plan. So we went with that with some consistency, and that was sort of the baseline tool people were going to use. And Google Meet, Google Hangout, Google Docs, things like that, all connected to our learning management system that we already had in place. And then teachers are going from there and using other tools. And John can talk a little bit about that, some of what's happening in the social studies department. But we're finding a blend of synchronous and asynchronous experiences, and then supporting individual students in really creative ways. So we have a team that we call our CARS team, our Care for At-Risk Students team, which typically we meet once a week. Well, we've already had three meetings. We have our fourth tomorrow in the short amount of time, where we're able to identify from feedback from teachers and counselors and our mental health professionals on who's struggling, who's not engaging. And we're doing some real intense direct outreach and problem solving with those kids. And I'm happy to say it's a really small number of students who are struggling. And the struggles that were the challenges really vary from sort of the isolation of like, how do I deal with this isolation? How do I deal with being with my family, competing for internet, you know, making sure they're connecting, finding ways to connect remotely with peers and other adults. So I feel really proud of the work that we've done, and I'm going to sort of stop talking now and let you ask questions and John add more, but that's just a background.
John, did you want to add to that? Or
sure. So I would agree with Mark and Meg that it's been a pretty impressive transition. And you know, the fact that we've been up and running now for 2 weeks, you know, 2 weeks is really amazing. And the kids' response overall has been really positive as well. I think fortunately there was a lot of things working in our favor. So much of the kind of the workflow piece of like getting information out to students and students, you know, turning in papers was more and more become more and more digital in the past couple of years. So a lot of that hasn't changed. You know, students have, you know, for the vast majority of students who have good, you know, who have access to the internet, can access our online learning platform. They can see what's being assigned. They can turn in their work. That stuff we were doing even when we were all meeting in a classroom. So that foundation made it easy then to you know, start to figure out ways to be creative about holding class. And what I've stressed in my classes and what I've stressed to my department is the focus really is on, you know, keeping it simple, especially at the start, less being more, and really doing our best to try to preserve that kind of classroom culture that was so important in our classes before we all ended up in, you know, our own homes. And so those 40-minute meetings allow us to do that, you know, having, you know, conversation like this, having the classes meet virtually, and being able to see each other, being able to hear each other, being able to answer questions, being able to deliver a short lesson, you know, deliver a lecture, you know, have a debate, break the students up into a bunch of different groups like we're having right now. So I've divided my class into 5 or 7 different little groups, and I can jump in and out of the different chats and, you know, have a small group interaction with them and be able to talk to them, and, you know, in a smaller group and more personally. Those things have allowed us to preserve that culture, that connection, which I think is more important than any lesson, you know, in particular lesson that I'm going to deliver. And so that's gone really well in the past 2 weeks.
I was just wondering, how has this affected like AP classes or special ed classes, you know, where you have other situations going on besides a traditional kind of class? Mm-hmm. Has that been more of a challenge, or has that been able to be something you've been able to navigate through as well?
Well, I'll talk a little bit about our special services. Our special services department is doing an unbelievable job of meeting the needs of all of the students who have an individualized education plan or a 504 plan. And every case manager reached out to families individually and made contact, described what the program would be, how they'd be working with their students, how the program would change. And so I would say that we have one level of special education where students are in what we call a study skills class that supports and is connected to their regular ed classes. And those are just ongoing, like John described for his history classes. And then students who have more profound needs, those are individual plans, but each one of our students, it does have a continuing ongoing program that's being facilitated remotely, which is amazing to me.
I can speak.
I also want to give a shout out to parents, because particularly in those situations where everyone's isolated in their homes, our parents parents and guardians are playing a crucial role in being with their high needs kids and helping them continue their education, you know, through our program. So it's a team effort.
Yeah, I would just add, in regards to what Meg was saying, so my wife is actually also, Sarah Dolan Graf is also a teacher at Burn Burton, and she's a learning specialist. She teaches those study skills classes. And so, you know, what she's doing every, you know, while I'm here in my son's bedroom holding my classes, she's in a different part of the house meeting with her students in small groups and individually, and providing that, you know, that direct support that Meg was describing to them throughout the day. For the, you know, so they're getting that same attention, that same support that she was giving them in her classroom. Just it's, you know, via the internet.
And what about the varying levels of broadband that the students have at home? Has that been a problem, or any kind of issue, or has it basically been kind of good enough to be able to allow you to do what you need to do?
John, why don't you talk about what you've encountered with students, and I can add another perspective.
Yeah, I'd say by and large, it's been really successful. One of the things that students and teachers are figuring out is that there's ways to maximize your bandwidth. So for if some kids are just using audio or using video only at specific times. I've had all my students in my classes have been able to access the class via the internet and been part of this online learning. And they're sometimes their voices are a little crackly. Sometimes mine is. I found that if I'm going to present something to them, I want to turn off my camera so it's not taking up bandwidth, and the bandwidth can be the presentation, the slideshow that's being projected is the thing that's coming to them most clearly. So it's a small sample, but for my classes, it's been really successful, and kids have been able to access and participate.
Of the things we did was we sent out one of our maintenance personnel in a bus to different locations where we knew the Wi-Fi signals were maybe not as strong, and did some tests to see, okay, so if he parked in this particular parking lot, say in Landgrove or Londonderry or Peru or Pollitt, what was the signal like there, just to get a sense. And we were then able to help students figure out through some of the work that the town of Manchester did where they could access some of that. So I know we do have a few students who are sitting in their car sometimes when they have a class that has a high need for bandwidth close to a building where they can access the Wi-Fi.
And I was wondering, how has this affected the kids up at the Mountain Campus? They're kind of in a different curriculum.
Right.
Has that been
altered at all? They actually were up and running a few days before we were, and had a really strong plan in place. And Andrew, I'm working on an article for our Bullhorn, which goes out tomorrow. And when I finish that, I'll send that to you. And it has links to a number of examples of how teachers, and there are some good examples from the Mountain Campus that show what they're doing remotely to sort of bring that program to life.
And that could be a story in and of itself, by the way, Andrew, because, taking a program like the Mountain Campus that is by design highly experiential and turning it into something that can be delivered online is no easy trick. But I think they're being successful, and I think you'd enjoy talking to Andy Dahlstrom, who's the director, and maybe some of the faculty or even students for that matter.
Okay. Yeah. I guess just to kind of conclude here, is there anything about remote online learning that you think, wow, this is like kind of cool, and this is something we could do after COVID-19 is a memory?
I'll tell you a little anecdote. My advisory, the day we were explaining the plan to the students, one of them said, "So what you're telling us is snow days are gone forever?" And I think I was like, well, think this, I don't want to say that because everybody, including our faculty and staff, loves a snow day now and again, but, it does make me wonder in the future, if we get above a certain amount, do we go to remote learning days and not really snow days? And there are some things that could change. The other thing is it's interesting, the feedback that so many of us have received from students, like, wow, I really took it for granted And when I get back in that building, like, I'm no longer going to take it for granted because I miss being there. I miss the community. I miss all of you. So I don't see this as like, oh, yes, now remote learning. Yay, yay, yay. I think if anything, people are realizing it has its place and it's serving us well, but people want to be together.
Yeah, yeah. I would agree. My students are, you know, they're, it's not like they're all celebrating that they're not coming to school on a daily basis. They're making the best out of a challenging situation and happy that we can be together in the way that we are. But man, they would love to be back on campus right now.
Yeah. And
I'll chime in a couple thoughts. Number one, the technology is amazing in its strength and in its simplicity. And it's both. And that's what enables this to all work, is that we can see everybody on a screen together, just like we're doing right now. And it's easy enough to use that any one of us in 5 minutes pretty much figures it out. So the technology is an amazing platform. This has happened deep into the school year. So we have all this momentum. We have all these relationships built. And we are able to continue the momentum. I will tell you personally, it's killing me not to have people around. I'm not set up for social isolation. I miss everybody and I miss the daily energy, and I know I'm not alone in that. And so I can't wait for the day when we have 750 students and 150 faculty and staff back here together doing what we do well and doing really what we love. So it's good for now, but I can't wait for everybody coming back together as a real community, not just a virtual community.
Do you think there's a chance you're going to have a commencement graduation exercises as normal, or is that still up in the air?
You know, this Meg's taking her sip of coffee and saying, so everyone knows I'm a ridiculous optimist. And so I have all kinds of hope. A phrase I also say often is hope is not a strategy. So I have hope. I will tell you we have a commitment. We will absolutely make sure we celebrate the class of 2020 in ways large and small, and we'll deal with whatever cards are dealt to us from COVID coronavirus. I would love to see us back together. If we have to move graduation to July, I wouldn't mind moving the ceremony to midsummer or late summer. If we have to get creative, we have creative people. So we're going to make it work. And one of the things that is clearly enduring through all of this is this sense of bulldog spirit that's been, you know, we have a daily message from a student and that's propagating this spirit. And, you know, you can feel it everywhere. And we're going to capture it and celebrate when we get to the summertime, one way or the other. I just don't know how we're going to do it yet.
Mm. Well, I hope it all works out. I guess any other thoughts or takeaways or things you wanted to say before I signed off here? I don't want to hold you up too long here because I'm sure you're all busy and everything, but was there something I didn't ask you about that you wanted to say?
You had asked about the AP classes. I would just, the College Board has come out and made a change so that the students can take, they've made a modified test that's shorter, and it's going to be, the students can complete it online in their homes. And so that's, you know, all those classes are just making the adjustments necessary to make sure they're best prepared for that. But we're responding to the changes that they put out last week.
Okay. Well, yeah, an awful lot of adjustment. I mean, I have to tell you, I'm not sure I'm loving working from home either.
That's definitely a challenge.
So my closing thought, Andrew, would be, you know, number one, I want to send an incredible note of gratitude to our students, their families, and our faculty for doing as much as we have done so far in this adventure. And second, and it's of the highest priority, is I want to wish everyone good health, and hopefully we stay healthy as a community. And the last thing I want to say is that we are all incredibly grateful to our first responders in the healthcare industry who are literally putting their lives and well-being at risk to keep us all safe. So we're grateful to be where we are in a community like the one we're in. So there it is.
Mm. Well, hopefully this all ends very soon, sooner than later.
Here.
Well, okay. Well, great. Thank you all so much for your time today and sharing this. And I'll get to work on editing it and putting it out there. Great. And good
thank
luck.
You.
I hope I look forward to seeing you all at the graduation.
Absolutely. Thank you, Andrew.
All righty. Have a good day.
See you, John. See you, Meg.
Have a good one. See you tomorrow.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening local. For more local content, visit GNAT.tv.